broadcasting from the campus of Salisbury University. This is WSDL Ocean City 90.7 FM, Delmarva Public Radio. It's time now for a special writer's edition of Delmarva Today with host Harold Wilson.
The promise of the internet and social media in particular was that it would not only allow anyone the opportunity to speak, but would also make it possible for anyone to precisely tailor what he reads, sees, and hears online. News and information would no longer be mediated by newspaper editors, television producers, and other gatekeepers. Instead, social media would allow direct access to individual voices in a feed custom built by the user. It was a new frontier for both unregulated free expression and individual control. Peter Sudeman, in the opinion section of the New York Times on September 11, 2018. Welcome to Delmarva Today, Writer's Edition. I'm your host, Harold Wilson. Today is the third in our series of programs on free speech. The first, on January 26th of this year, discussed the challenges of free speech on college campuses. The second aired on April 27 and considered whether free speech is being seriously challenged in civil society today. Our program today is the third in the series and addresses the question of the meaning of free speech in the digital age. It's clear that the internet and social media have radically changed the nature of communication, the way information is broadcast and received today, and perhaps even the way we see ourselves. To use a really fancy 50-cent word, we are experiencing a global paradigm shift. A change in the model or pattern in the way we experience the world. It's a world now where anyone, individual, corporation, or group anywhere can express their beliefs, thoughts, convictions, desires, and so forth, without fear of being coerced into silence. And it's a world where we can receive these thoughts, beliefs, convictions, desires, and admonitions of others, and respond, if we wish, in the privacy of our own domains. Oddly enough, this represents both a separation and a connection. As Peter Sunderman says, that world is one in which speech is often perceived not as an individual right, but as a public act, in which words and ideas are not our own, but a contribution to the collective. He says that social media has, in effect, socialized speech. Is Sunderman right? And if so, what is the place of free speech in this new age of socialized speech, this digital age? To weigh in on this important issue, my guests are Don Rush, Associate Program Director, Senior Producer in News and Public Affairs at Delmarva Public Radio, and Adam Wood, Chairman of the Department of English at Salisbury University and Chair of the Committee on Academic Freedom and Tenure. Adam and Don also appeared in the first two broadcasts on free speech. Also joining us today is Dr. Jennifer Cox, associate professor on the communication and arts faculty at Salisbury University. Welcome to all of you.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you.
Thank you.
First, an important contextual question. We talk about free speech in the digital age, but what constitutes the digital age? What are its elements, and what is its impact on the global community? In our opening, I suggested that it represents a paradigm shift in the way we experience the world. Am I right about that? Don, let's start with you, and then Adam and Jennifer, you probably want to just join in as you wish.
So the idea of speech as a public act as opposed to, say, for instance, a private act. In short, what he's essentially saying is that we are no longer speaking to one person, we're speaking to a group of people or even a crowd. And it becomes basically a digital square. The thing that struck me as I was thinking about this, that there is an element to the digital age and social media which makes it probably qualitatively different than what we've seen in the past, say, particularly the 18th century technology when the concept of free speech and the free press was certainly created. Two of those elements seems to be is both time and place. And if you think about, for instance, a mob, in the 18th century, a mob was confined by time and space. Mm. They gathered in a square, they did whatever they did, and then they left. In the modern age, in the virtual mob, there is no place. They can be anywhere at any time. And there is no time in terms of they can last forever. So, if, for instance, if you say something that a bunch of people don't like, they can follow you forever and do literally damage. I suppose the other element to this, and the thing that you allude to, is the idea that unlike 18th century technology and even the technology that followed was the absence of a gatekeeper. The best thing we can think of is perhaps the people who have the platforms. Those are probably the only gatekeepers, and they're certainly not editorial gatekeepers. So I think you have a dramatic difference between what has gone before, whether it was print, whether it's even broadcast, which had limits, had fairness doctrines, and so on, as opposed to what we have now, which is something that, in terms of free speech and the idea of a free press, was way beyond anything that was conceived, at least by the framers of the Constitution.
Don, we've got a whole new jargon associated with the digital age, and you just used the term platform.
Right.
Before Jennifer and Adam weigh in on the socialization of speech, what are the platforms that we're talking about? What is a platform in the digital age?
So most people are often familiar with, say, for instance, Facebook and Twitter. That's probably the most controversial. Although obviously you have blogs and then standard regular internet sites as well. So one of the questions is, what is the responsibility of the people who privately own these, unlike, for instance, the airwaves, in which the government actually owns the airwaves? What kind of responsibility do they have in terms of the material that is coming across that platform? Are they simply people who simply print up the newspaper, or the people who distribute the newspaper? What is their role? And it's clearly, it's much different than the distributor of a newspaper or the printer. This is something that they will have to take responsibility for in some fashion. And the various, obviously, we just had a hearing, congressional hearing not too long ago, about Google and so on, search engines, about that particular responsibility. What is a responsibility? And a lot of the platform companies like Facebook are trying to scramble to find out, well, what should we be doing, especially given the events of 2016, but even beyond.
Well, Adam and Jennifer, socialized speech, is Sunderman right about this?
Oh, okay.
Go ahead.
I think one of the interesting things about the digital age, and
And just to kind of get back to the first important contextual question, what constitutes the digital age? I'm actually working on a textbook right now in which I use the term digital age, feature storytelling in the digital age, for journalists. And so I had to start with, what does that mean? What is the digital age? And technically, it started in the 70s with the advent of the internet and the developed, you know, kind of with the personalization, home computers, things like that. But what I think is fascinating about the digital age and why I don't really go all the way back that far when I think about the digital age and why most of us don't, is that technology and innovation has increased so exponentially in that time. You know, we're not talking about the timeline between the printing press and the fax machine and the, you know, Morse code and radio. Those things developed slowly over decades. Now we're talking about new innovations every day. And so it's just coming so, so fast, and which is why it's so important that we have this conversation, because it's happening, it's evolving faster than we can regulate it. It's happening faster than we can even wrap our heads around. And I think this concept of a socialization of speech is a really interesting one. And obviously we're going to dive in deeper into that, but I think it's so fascinating that we can have a community based on shared interests, based on shared space, that we really didn't have the opportunity before. I actually gave a talk about this a little bit, the digital revolution, a few years ago at Salisbury University, and one of the examples that I used, kind of the layman's example, is my mom was a quilter. And before, she could work in a quilt shop or hang out at the quilt shop. You don't really do that. And then, you know, the internet came along, blogs and message boards and things like that. And she found a community of like-minded people. And then they used that opportunity to get together in real life and have retreats and social gatherings and things like that. In my master's degree, my degree is in community journalism. And so we heavily studied Putnam and his idea of bowling alone, how social media, essentially online communication, is breaking down our sense of actually spatial togetherness. And I argued against it then, and I continue to do that now. I think we've seen social media present a lot of opportunities for us to mobilize as a community and to really put our speech out there as part of a community, as part of a movement. So there's good power, and then of course there's using it for evil too, and
we're
going to
talk about the evil. I think we'll talk a little about the evil.
I think just one other thing that I would kind of chime in on with this is the idea that while it is a sort of much larger global community when we think about the internet and that sort of thing, that the individual communities within there still seem to isolate themselves from each other. That very often there is. You know, there's not really as often the exchange of different ideas as much as a particular website or a particular channel sort of having just the same idea sort of repeated over and over again. And so, you know, the possibility that this would allow for greater global conversations and discourse, I think, has often been limited by a term that is getting thrown around often as sort of a tribalism, where individual communities are simply having conversations with themselves as opposed to engaging with those who may have different political beliefs or religious beliefs or ideas.
So that's the downside of the ability of the groups to come together and just do their thing, is that even though there's the opportunity to reach out to the world. I mean, I had some friends in France that I had lost contact with, and all of a sudden, they're showing up on Facebook now. So I have reconnected with them. Right. But that's kind of the downside, is that we isolate ourselves in our tribe. These platforms. Is that what you're saying?
I think unfortunately that's something that does tend to happen more than perhaps we'd like to see. But you know, that may also just be simply the natural evolution of things, that people tend to gravitate towards beliefs that they hold. They tend to gravitate towards others who tend to agree with them, and so you simply end up with these sort of echo chambers, right? I mean, we even think in terms of the proliferation of sort of different internet news outlets, where people on the left tend to look at the handful of sites that sort of cater to their beliefs, and people on the right tend to look at the handful of websites that cater to their beliefs. And so even though there's a far greater amount of information out there. I think far too often people are not really looking for anything other than a confirmation of what they tend to already think.
So the socialized that for you is the socialized nature of the internet and of the platforms that that we're on.
I would also suggest that it allows people, organizations, to reach into the individual. Is sort of like reaching, you know, the best way to reach the man is to get him alone in the crowd, which is essentially what's happening here, in which you've got not only businesses, but certainly political activities that are micro-targeted to individuals so that you can then reinforce those beliefs or reinforce the particular product that you want. So it gives greater access to the individual, I think, for various entities, as opposed to what we used to have to do before, which was, say, for instance, advertising television, for example, in which we had to have, you know, large audiences. Well, who are we going to be targeting? How are we going to get a hold of them? This allows entities to reach directly into individuals' homes, as it were. And I think in essence, it develops a certain fragmentation of society that we didn't have before. So, you know, in the late 1960s and early 70s, you could all sit around and have this massive audience, right, for some, you know, for Dallas and Who Shot JR, right? Huge audiences. Well, that probably is not going to happen anymore. And you can actually see that in terms of the diminishing audience for both commercial broadcasting and even cable broadcasting television. You can see those things now silo down. So I think it does promote this fragmentation, which we see, as Adam says, about how we're socializing.
I think an interesting addition to what Adam said was, you know, that confirmation bias. We saw that manifest so much with the election, and it led to so much polarization. There's been study after study that shows, you know, liberals are going to seek news that reinforces what they already believe. Conservatives are going to do the same. And then you see so many people taking those views to social media platforms and creating a discourse that is not productive. You see them coming at it with their confirmation bias, unwilling to budge or be challenged in that. And that led to a real distrust in the media, which is my area. And so I've been looking into this a lot. And a lot of journalists have been looking into, you know, why are the media becoming the scapegoats? Why are we the ones who are not to be trusted? And is that even true? Do people not trust the media? And when you actually talk to them one-on-one, as you were suggesting, you know, you get them in a one-on-one situation, they do. They'll read the local newspaper. They'll listen to DPR. They trust us. But they don't trust the institution of media because of the way that people select their own media to share. They don't divorce the person and their beliefs and their confirmation bias from the outlet that's providing it. And that's been a big part of the challenge, and I think really speaks to the socialization of this type of thing.
Yeah. I mean, just one other thing to sort of add on to that, I think, is that the position of anonymity on the internet is sort of a very interesting thing, where you very often will see people will sort of create some sort of online account simply to take pot shots at someone, right? Mm-hmm. And that it doesn't require sort of putting oneself at stake for making either charges or accusations against someone. Or even just, you know, blindly sort of attacking them and then sort of retreating into, you know, the netherworld. And so, again, I think that also goes to that a decline in discourse in some ways, that it's simply the easy pot shots. I mean, even you just think about the comment sections, even on YouTube or something like that, where, you know, an anonymous person will just say something vicious and hateful. And then, you know, there'll be sort of a back and forth, but no one knows who any of these people are. None of it's sort of substantiated in any way. But that seems to have become almost a sad type of sport, I think, in the digital age.
Well, I think it's interesting to go to your comment, Don, is that the social media allows for our anonymity to be broken also, even though we respond and we can respond in an anonymous way. And the advertising that you mentioned, Don, because I know Marilyn went shopping on the internet the other day and looked at a couple of sites. And then I looked up some information on the internet. And all of a sudden, I'm getting advertisements specifically directed to what I was searching on Google, as an example. And then Marilyn, what my wife was looking at in her Christmas shopping, now all of a sudden I go on Facebook or even on other platforms, and I've got ads for the kinds of things. And then a separate kind of little thing that says, here are similar items that other people are looking for. So all of a sudden, instead of targeting this mass media, all of a sudden the internet and the digital age has allowed the intrusion of advertising to me directly.
I mean, we do have this illusion that because we're sitting in our homes or at an office that we're alone when we operate the internet. But what we've really done is we've walked out onto this virtual public square. If you're walking around a department store, even though you don't really realize it, and there's an illusion that you're not really doing that because, after all, you're physically alone. It's one of these things where you reach in and, I try to limit my shopping on the internet, But again, it's that kind of thing where you can be, so the more people know more about us than ever before, and in ways that we are not aware of, as opposed to, say, pre-internet, in which, well, yeah, of course, most people would not know what we buy or when we walk through a store. Now they know. So more of our lives are on full display. I mean, there's a certain, 1984-ish quality to this, where they're watching us all the time. Now, and obviously the most extreme impact, I think, was the book, I think The Circle, I think, in which people go clear, in which everybody can see everything you do. We probably won't be to that point, but nonetheless, it's almost as if we're living in glass houses.
Yes, it's an intrusion. At least I experience intrusion.
The problem is that we go out, it's not really so much an intrusion, as we don't realize that we're going out into the world. Mm.
So many ruined holiday presents.
Yes. Well, there's also the creation of the dark web in some ways in response to this, right? And, I think most people, when they hear the term dark web, they think of child pornography or, any number of terrible things. And Jennifer may know much more about this than I do, but apparently, the vast majority of the dark web is simply people seeking anonymity, right? That they don't want to have their information sort of out there in that sort of way. And so, again, you've got this sort of secondary platform, although they say that the dark web is much larger than what we think of as the standard web. It's interesting that for every sort of move into our lives, there always seems to arise out of that an attempt to get around that in some way or another. Which, again, of course, the problem with the dark web is that it does have all these horrible things on there as well. But there, it is a place where one can theoretically go without being seen in some ways.
Mm-hmm. I think there's an interesting point that Don brought up in that, we're not really being invaded so much as we are putting ourselves right out there. And I think that this is a great moment in history for us as humans to recognize that we have to be accountable for our actions, for the things we say, for the things that we write. You can't just, say something horribly offensive as a teenager and then not expect it to come back to you. And that's a part of who you are. And it's out there now for people to see. I have an 8-year-old daughter, and she's fighting me right now about creating a YouTube channel. And she just wants to open dolls with her friend on this YouTube channel. And how do you explain, why I don't want you to? There's sickos out there. There's people who are cruel. I'm protecting you from you. You don't know what's going to come back to haunt you. And we haven't really addressed yet when social media will be permissible for her. But, God, I hope it's a long time from now.
Well, we said that social media socializes us. But I have a feeling that social media also separates us, that we are both connected and not connected, because as you mentioned, Don, we're sitting there in our little office at home or in an office somewhere, and nothing but our computer, and we deal with the world through that keyboard. Is there any sense that that there is kind of an individual separation that occurs in this digital age as well?
I think there is. There's certainly opportunities to separate. And one that you kind of that popped into my mind when you were talking about the dark market, the dark web, was, you know, I do all my searches for flights on private web browsers because I don't want them to raise the prices on me the next time I look.
Right.
And, you know, and then now I'm thinking, oh, you know, I should probably do my holiday shopping on there. I should probably do this. And it gets to a point where we're actually purposely hiding things from people. And so I can see us maybe even moving in that direction. And then there's, of course, the fragmentation. I mean, we live in this digital age where it's frankly possible for almost all of us to work out of our homes now. I mean, we could be sitting, we're in an office right now, but we could be sitting in your living room doing this. You know, we could be calling in. We don't even, the four of us wouldn't even need to be in the same room. And we're seeing more jobs like that. And I feel like it's creating a greater sense of isolation in our society as well. You know, we may be connected to everybody, but when you're physically alone, that can harbor some, you know, or can turn up some darkness. And that is a real concern.
Sarah, and I'll just throw this question out because I do not know the answer. How do you think all of this affects the way we think? You know, the suggestion was, for instance, when television came along, we were able to, say, move from sort of linear thinking to, right, pattern recognition, because we had to keep track of it, what everything was going. Is there anything going on, you think, in terms of this new medium, in terms of not just how we get out into the world, but how we actually construct the world for ourselves? I mean, I throw that out just as a...
I think hope that's it makes us more self-reflective. You hope.
Well, it doesn't seem so, does it?
Not yet, but I think we're about to see a big shift.
The one thing that I've noticed about the way we think, and I'm relating that not just to the way we think, but the way we're writing as a reflection of the way we think. And if you look at Facebook, if you look at email, we're writing in these short clip little thoughts that are not edited in general. They just come out. I'm wondering if that might be a reflection of, I said earlier that we see the world differently now. And maybe we see the world more as these short phrases and statements, and there are not the thoughtful, worked out thought patterns.
I mean, right, and we do, and even when you're looking at something on the internet, for example, if it's really long, you're probably not going to finish it. I mean, it's one of the things. So there's this constant sort of shrinking of the attention span, which then obviously will affect what we know about any given subject. So we may know what the basic idea is, but we're not sure what the foundation for it was. I mean, is that it, and there may be a change in how we think. I mean, I don't know.
I mean, I think there's a we've lost a sense of nuance, I think, in a lot of ways, right? When we think about the very idea of clickbait, right? That if you need to get someone to click on that right away. And so, you know, given the short form, the lack of nuance. And so, again, it's just sort of, instead of having a sort of extended and detailed analysis of, for example, Trump's economic policies, right? You simply have a headline that says, fascist Trump wants money or something, you know, and it's that instant sort of thing.
And that's all you need.
And that, and again, that's all you need.
But that's the way we, but I would suggest that that's the way we're seeing the world now.
Oh,
the,
I agree.
The world is horribly complex. But we're living, it seems to me anyway, as though it is not.
Although,
we're living as though it can be summarized in a brief little statement, as you're saying.
But although we're so overwhelmed by all the information, we must then pick out little tiny pieces, right? So that we can understand the world as we kind of like move through it. And the other thing that strikes me, and it's only because I was reading some of the back and forth in the early elections, you know, and Jefferson and Adams and so on. I must say that they probably could have fit in 240 characters or whatever it is, but they were far more elegant. And now, as a matter of fact, we tend to substitute punctuation and caps for elegance.
Let me ask our two professors in the room here, and particularly relative to your comment or your question, Don, about is it affecting the way we think now? When you look at your students, I'm sure your students have to write. What are you getting now in terms of thought processes, in terms of reasoning, in terms of arguing a point or laying out a theme, for example? Is there a change in the way students are thinking as a result of the way you see them writing?
And I can tell you, I come from kind of a different standpoint. You teach English,
right,
and so long form writing, very creative, very descriptive, whereas I teach journalism. You know, what is the literature in a hurry?
Right. That's right.
And so for me, I don't think there has been a shift in their attitude of thinking, because it's always been a challenge to broaden their attention spans. Even since I was a student, you know, you have a short attention span. There's a lot going on. You're 18, 19, 20. You don't want to sit there and read a long form magazine article. That was never the case. But what I'm trying to do in my classes, and what a lot of journalists and journalism organizations are trying to do, is teach what I think is a better way of journalism. We're not the ones breaking news anymore. Twitter is, Facebook is, YouTube is, Reddit is, you know, is spreading the breaking news. What journalists need to do to survive is to add context, to tell these feature stories, to ask the how and the why. And so that's what I'm trying to get my students to do, is to shift them from that breaking news mentality, which is really what they see, what they're exposed to a lot, and start thinking about, okay, fine, those are the stories you might glance at. What are the stories you share? What are the ones that really you actually dig your feet in and read? What are the audience-centric stories? Those are the ones you need to tell. And they're out there. I was actually looking for the text I'm writing. I was looking at the top 10 stories, top 10 most read news items of last year. And three of the top 10, a lot of them were hurricane related. All the different hurricanes had their own audiences. But then a lot of them were ones about tech news or environmental news, enterprise stories that have staying power, that really dive deep into an issue. People do care about these things. And so as journalists, as media, we have to rise above the din of just this, let's get stuff out, breaking news, because that's not our job anymore. Our job is to add context and value to that news. And I think that this shift, in a way, toward that shorter attention span, toward...
Well, this, you're fitting right in.
Yeah.
You're
I think I'm preaching to the choir
you
here.
You're teaching the digital age approach.
You're listening to DPR right now. This message is not for you.
That's right. Adam?
I think one of the things that I've noticed in the past... sort of increasing in the past, say, 10 years or so, is the that students more and more seem to believe that their emotional response is all that's needed to make an argument, right?
Yeah.
And again, I think because a lot of the the way that they interact on the internet is just is grounded in, well, my personal experience and my emotional response is this. And they have sort of come to believe that that's how the world works. If I like it, it's good, or if I don't like it, it's bad, as opposed to actually really digging in, as Jennifer was saying, sort of looking at sort of an extended research, even in terms of the kind of research they do. And I don't mean to have a sort of a good old days or bad old days notion, but that there was a time before the internet where doing research, for example, for a paper that you're writing, took you a lot of time, that you actually had to go into a physical building that housed books and journals and pore through them in order to find the information that was best for you. And you'd end up reading, 30 things to cite 4 of them in the long run, where now, they have their perspective, they know what they want to say, and they simply Google that exact phrase, and then they find the first 3 things that pop up that agree with them, and they believe that they're doing good research, where it's really not. It's simply, well, I found these 3 things that agree with what I say, therefore this must be true. Mm-hmm. And so, I think that shift to a greater emphasis on I emotionally feel this way, so therefore it must be true, has really taken a toll on a lot of student output these days.
Do you find at all a shortage of extended thought, the ability to take that idea that they Google and find and think linearly about it?
Yeah, I think in some ways. I mean, again, all of our argumentation, whether we're in journalism or any field in some ways, is always it's always going to emerge to a certain extent from our own personal beliefs, right? I mean, if you are left-leaning, that's obviously going to affect the kind of journalism you're interested in, or X, Y, and Z. But at the same time, I think the idea that the classic sense of argumentation is that I'm writing for people who are going to disagree with me, and I need to do my best to convince them to rethink how they're approaching something. Where again, now so much of the writing is simply, well, I'm writing for my group, my tribe, my community, whatever it is, that I no longer have to convince anyone. I just can say it, and I know that this group of people who already agree with me will say, yes, you're totally right about that. And so, again, I think the very idea of public discourse, right, an actual debate back and forth in some ways, has sadly gone away. I mean, it's still out there. We even think about how so often a lot of, if you look at YouTube and sort of the public intellectuals, it's one of the only times that you actually see multiple people having a conversation, as opposed to people just sort of filming themselves giving a monologue, right? And so again, that idea of, well, let's create new ideas by having a discourse with people who might think differently than us, seems to have been something that I think's really been lost of late.
Well, we've been talking about kind of who we are in the digital age now, and what effect and impact it has on us. Let me shift our gears a little bit here, and we talked a little bit earlier about the big tech platforms, and the question in terms of free speech and the internet really runs to some degree to what are the responsibilities of the gatekeepers, for one, and what are the responsibilities of the users of the internet? And let me sharpen the question a little bit here. We had a very lively discussion about banning speakers on college campuses, some who have bizarre ideas and so forth. Should people or groups be banned from social media?
Well, that's really the $64,000 question, isn't it?
That's the question.
Because as a return to my original thesis, which is this is not a technology that was born out of the 18th century. Mm-hmm. Okay? So there's suddenly, it's a power that's beyond anything that we've had before. So we see people trying to struggle with this. For instance, we take a look at the Europeans, for instance. The French are talking about, say, banning the so-called fake news. They're trying to make perhaps people more transparent in terms of who's paying for it, and essentially to give regulators more power to remove fake news. The Germans, they want to, say, for instance, ban hate speech. And, of course, they have their own particular history with the Germans and the Nazis and so on. But, in fact, they're talking about imposing, say, a 50 million euro fine on social media companies that don't delete within 24 hours hate speech, for example. And there's even talk in Britain about trying to limit. So society is trying to come to grips with how do you deal with this new technology which can spread ideas which can be highly disruptive to society itself, right? That's part of its problem. So we're not so much now the freewheeling sort of newspaper guys of the, you know, 18th, 19th century anymore, although they newspapers did their own destructive things. But now we're talking about something that's completely out of control, both in terms of gatekeepers, because we say we don't really need gatekeepers, and even the government itself. How do we do that? I don't know how we do that. The Europeans are suggesting there are certain things. The platform folks, for instance, Google and so on and so forth, they're talking about changing the way they say, for instance, Facebook will take things off their network because they're fake news or perhaps in the case of the Russians, oh, it's a Russian bot. So we had the introduction of bots, which is a whole nother thing. Because before you wouldn't have, you know, in the 18th century, you wouldn't have like automatic things, right, where you couldn't track them down, you couldn't know where they came from. So those are the problems that society is dealing with this particular medium, which goes beyond, I think, simply the concept of free speech and free press, which I think are fused together in this particular technology.
Where do you go? Where does free speech cross the line into discrimination? Are we saying that discrimination is legal because it's a form of free speech? And, you know, we've seen a lot of court cases about this come up lately. Right. The baker in Colorado that refused to bake the wedding cakes for the same-sex couples. And, you know, we've seen a lot of things like that. And frankly, like, I'm like you, Don, I feel like we're not very helpful here because I don't know the answer. You know, I think maybe advantage. I was just reading an article from the New York Times about the advantages to having the five big tech platforms. Like, it's not all bad. And the biggest advantage is that they can be regulated, and they're not government agencies. Government agencies can't have you pray before a meeting, but a private company can. And so we do put a lot of pressure on organizations like Facebook and Apple and Amazon to regulate their material because they can. And we as free market consumers have the right and have exercised it to boycott those when we feel like they're not representative of our views. And so, you know, is this such a bad thing? Yeah, there's a lot of disadvantages to the big tech five kind of ruling the world. But I think that there are some advantages that maybe having them be government regulated can't
as a utility.
Do. Right. We're so afraid to break away from this, you know, 17th century definitions of, you know, First Amendment rights. And we're afraid to clarify. And we certainly are seeing this with, you know, right to bear arms. How do you rectify that with the fact that they couldn't have imagined the technology we have now? It's the same thing with the First Amendment. You know, they couldn't have imagined at that point what resources would be available to us and what potential damages there could be. So the free market's going to have to kind of figure that out, I think.
Yeah, I think it's an interesting thing that sort of two issues are flip sides of the same thing. The notion of a sort of an ethical perspective of do these corporations or, you know, even if we think of something like YouTube, right? Does it have an ethical obligation to limit certain kinds of speech, right? And so, you know, there's obvious cases where if someone's calling for violence, right, which violates the notions of free speech, and that's sort of removed. You get into the recent example of Alex Jones, though, right, who says a ton of wacky, outrageous things, and then, you know, he sort of is deplatformed in that way. Was that because, for example, YouTube or Facebook, whichever it was, because they felt ethically compelled to shut him down? Or is it a question of capitalism that, well, a lot of our viewers are younger and more liberal and they will stop they will pull away from our platform if we don't yank him down, right? And so again, I think that there's, you know, anytime money comes in and complicates those questions about free speech, it gets even murkier in some ways, right? Alex Jones, again, he says all kinds of terrible things. Sandy Hook conspiracy theories, right. Mm-hmm. Any number of these sorts of things. But he's also very aware of the line that he is skirting, right? And so, again, it begs a very interesting question of, do we deplatform those who we disagree with, even if they have not violated free speech in some way?
Although these platforms are not ours. They are individual companies.
Right.
Who can do anything they want.
Right.
Mm-hmm. I mean, they can literally, if they want to ban everything that's conservative, for example, right? They can do it, right? The other question I have is whether or not the marketplace is necessarily the answer to resolving some of the issues that we've raised, particularly in terms of speech that can incite or speech that spreads falsehoods, right. That kind of thing. You know, marketplace can do lots of great things, but it needs to be highly regulated in order to be really efficient, including transparency, right. For example. So I wonder whether or not we should be relying necessarily strictly on the marketplace, or whether these things need to be regulated in some fashion. We certainly did it with a broadcast in terms of both radio and television. We had fairness doctrines. And we have, you know, can't say certain words. You can't have, you know, there's real regulations on that. That was in part due to the fact that there was a limited number of channels, and the government owns those channels. We have less regulation, but still there, with something like, for instance, cable networks, right? And then public access, for instance, public access television, for example, cannot refuse anyone. So, for example, I think it was in Los Angeles, I think we had somebody who was a white nationalist, and he was head member of the KKK, and they could not keep him from broadcasting on public access, right? Mm-hmm. So there are degrees to which we could regulate these things, certainly as utilities, if nothing else. And that may require something, but I don't know what that is.
you know, as a journalist, though, I want to say, welcome to the world of ethics.
That's right.
It's about time that everybody else, because we've always been beholden to certain ethics. And one of the things that we talk about in my class is that there are distinct differences between ethics and laws. You know, you can't be arrested for violating journalistic ethics, but you most certainly can be fired and blackballed from your industry. And it's nice to see others come under those same rules. One of the things we talk about when we talk about media literacy is, you know, journalists are penalized for lying. We're fired. We're blackballed. As a government official, chances are you get a raise. So, you know, it's
well, you
nice.
Might be fired. Yeah.
depending. Right. But yeah, it's nice to see, you know, that there is some pressure to be ethical. But I think you're right. There does need to be, you know, some form of regulation. We need to find some kind of balance.
Ethics are often in the eye of the beholder. That's one of the problems with depending on ethics. Another issue with regulation is that a problem with regulation is that we're dealing with the digital age. We're dealing with a global phenomenon. And to regulate Facebook, as an example, means that we're regulating Facebook in France, we're regulating Facebook in Japan, we're imposing our view, we're imposing our restrictions on other countries. And is at least something to give one pause because we regulate relative to our mores, relative to our customs, relative to our societal feelings, and these may not be shared in Singapore or in France as an example. So. All I'm indicating here is that this is not a simple issue at all. And I said at the beginning of the broadcast that we're looking at a shift a very significant shift. Maybe what we're looking at is a sea change in society and in our global communications. And to go back to your comment earlier, maybe the tide is still coming in, and the water is still rising, and we're not really sure in the midst of this global digital activity. We're frankly not really sure how it should be controlled or how it should be regulated. But this particular author, Pen Huang, has an interesting chart. And he lays out, and I'll ask you to respond to it, he lays out a regulatory framework. And the regulatory framework, he suggests, goes something like, and I'll just do the types of regulators that he sees. The first one is the actor. Those who use are the regulators. You regulate what you want to say, you regulate. And that's the ethical issue to some extent as well. The second are second-party controllers, and that those are contractual provisions, self-help mechanisms, and so forth. The third is social norms. You allow social norms to be the regulator, social sanctions, hierarchically organized non-governmental organization. I guess that means that Facebook organizes itself and controls itself. That's kind of industry self-regulation. He's got done. And then the last one he would go to is governments. And the governments are the law. So there's kind of the self and filtering software and the third codes of conduct, the fourth industrial or industry self-regulation, and the third law. All of the above or some of the above or... How do we regulate this? How do we even look at beginning to regulate this this digital sea that we're swimming in now?
Well, I think just to add one other complication to it is that there really is no way to do it, right? Even if we think, to use Alex Jones again, even if he's banned from YouTube and Facebook, it's not as if there's nowhere that he can go to spout his, you know, knuckleheaded beliefs. And again, and so if he goes to another platform and gets banned off of that, he'll simply move on to another one. And so he's not being denied in some ways a platform. He's just being denied certain platforms, right? But again, I think one other thing I would just kind of add on to that is that one of the things that I think is different in some ways on the internet is that you don't have to hear speech that you don't like on the internet, right? If we think about... free speech in public, right? That if someone's on a street corner shouting things and you have to walk by them, you're going to hear it, right? So if they're shouting about Sandy Hook conspiracies, right, you're going to hear it. But if you don't want to know that on the internet, if you aren't interested in that, you don't have to do that. And so it becomes a very interesting notion of do we have a right to ban something even though we're not going to read it, we're not going to look at it, but just because we don't like the idea of it. And so I think just one other complication I wanted to throw in there.
Well, thank you for that.
We need more complications.
Yeah.
Don? Well, reading about the free speech issue as it exists when they wrote this thing, was the idea that speech and the press, for that matter, were supposed to be corrective measures in our society, so that if there were bad ideas, they could be corrected by having other ideas and or being criticized. And that was one of the basic functions of free speech. Mm-hmm. Wasn't free speech and the freedom of the press, particularly speech, was not a virtue in and of itself for the founders. Right. That it was not inherent. It was a way to allow society to move forward with ideas that made sense and that could progress. I think these days, I think we have a tendency to think of free speech as something that is absolute in and of itself, is inherently for itself rather than for society and in general. So I think regulating it in some fashion, and we already do, obviously, with libel laws and so on, is appropriate. Maybe part of the way you get it, and I'm talking about necessarily specific regulations, but we're talking about Alex Jones finding another platform. The key to things like Facebook, Twitter, and the dominant ones is that if you are on those platforms, your ideas get spread much further than if, for instance, Alex Jones, say, goes on a minor one, for example. Because one of the things that struck me is that you, if you disseminate an idea over and over again over a large population and dominate people's minds with that particular idea, they're going to accept it, whether it's true or not. So it's not so matter of you have to, like, ban the bad idea, as in Allah, for instance, 1984, where they would burn the past, right? But rather, as long as you crowd out all the other ideas for your own ideas, saturate, then therefore you become far more effective. Those platforms, that's what they're there for. So when Alex Jones, for instance, loses his platform, say Facebook or one of these things, he's lost a great deal of influence.
Of course.
So I think that's that. There's that element to it.
Yeah. I think there's, and that's a great point, but I think there's, just jumping off of that, a danger in the power of repetition as well. You know, I mean, certainly we're seeing that right now. We know that repetition is an effective tool of persuasion. Yeah. That's why people have campaign signs in their in their lawns. They don't tell us anything. It's just the simple notion of repeating a name. And we're seeing, you know, the president doing this with this concept of fake news. That's now a thing that people think about, and his definition of it is deeply flawed. But we have people citing, you know, they hate the media because of fake news. Well, explain that to me. I can't, just fake news. And so there is a danger in this platform, allowing platforms for a repetitive message to seep in. That being said, I think that where a potential place to start that I kind of talked about before is when we're crossing a line into discrimination. There is some legal precedent there for you know, banning speech or banning actions that discriminate against others. And I think, again, with some of these cases that we've talked about, we're starting to see that where groups have retaliated because they have, you know, been oppressed because of somebody else's message.
Let me, we only have a couple of minutes left, so, but I actually want to introduce a whole new topic for the two or three minutes we've got left, and that is the freedom or the free speech of like the internet service providers, that they can do anything they want with your data that you have given them. Should you have the right to put a hold on your data, or do they have a blanket right to sell the information that you give to them by virtue of using their service?
I will say...
Where does their free speech end?
Right. And I will say, just before I play devil's advocate, that I hate that they can take my data and I hate what they can do with it, but... that being said, I work as a newspaper journalist still, and when I produce a video or write a story or take a photo and it is published in that outlet, it is no longer mine. I do not own it. I can't reproduce it without their permissions. Even though I took it, it's technically, you know, my data, it's in my camera, they now own it, and I accept that responsibility when I take it to their platform. And I think as... you know, media consumers in this digital age, we have to shift our thinking to understand that. You know, my students always are appalled when I tell them, you need to make sure your Twitter feed's clean when you're out there applying for jobs, because the first thing they're going to do when they see you that you've applied is check your Twitter. And they're appalled by this. And how can they do that? That's an invasion of my privacy. I said, you forfeited your privacy when you put it out on the World Wide Web.
Well, it's like Don said, you stepped out into the world.
Yeah, you have to, we have to think differently. And so, like I guess I said, I hate that you know, I get targeted advertising for certain things that I might look at or buy, but I have to take responsibility for that if that's how I choose to conduct business.
Mm-hmm. Jennifer, Don, Adam, thank you all very much for this inconclusive but enlightened discussion of free speech in the digital age. I think it's been fascinating, and I want to thank you very much. Let me go back to Peter Suderman to end today's discussion, if I can. Peter Suderman says, "But all of us, as citizens and individuals and residents of the online world, have a responsibility to manage our own social media consumption, to resist letting it take over our thoughts, our lives, our culture, and our politics. Social media is only the real world if we let it be." Thanks again to all of you, and thanks to all of you for listening to Delmarva Today, Writer's Edition. I'm your host, Harold Wilson.
You've been listening to a special Writer's Edition of Delmarva Today with your host, Harold Wilson. This program is produced on the campus of Salisbury University for Delmarva Public Radio. Christopher Rank is your audio engineer. Mary Seaman is the volunteer producer. Visit our website, delmarvapublicradio.net, for podcasts of this program.